Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silly Cast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Friday, December 23rd, 2011, and this is show number 345. Well, we're recording a couple days early this week so Steve and I can run off and visit relatives for the holidays. First down to see my mom and brother and daughter on Christmas Eve, and then back up the state a ways to visit Steve's sisters and parents. Really looking forward to it, but I did not want you to go a week without a show. You know, other podcasts may take a break for the holidays, but not us. No best of show for us. New, fresh material every week. Well, surprisingly, we've got a fun-packed show today. The holidays haven't slowed us down a bit. I do want to warn you, as we get into the show, though, go dust off your propeller hats, because we're getting really technical on today's chit-chat across the pond. In this week's episode, I ask Steve and Bart to explain to me what the Higgs boson particle is and why we care. It gets pretty deep, but I think I kept up. Or as Osrose likes to say, I don't understand 75% of what Stevie P even tweets about, so this is going to be a rough one. You might actually want to go look at the show notes while you're listening to it, too. There's a picture, and there's some good text in there, some great show notes, so you can read along and try to keep up, because it's a, like I said, it's a pretty deep one. So hang on tight. On last week's show, I talked about the new simple recording application from Rogue Amoeba called Piezo. I gave it a hearty thumbs up and also mentioned that using VoiceOver, I couldn't figure out how to change the application that was being recorded. I suspected it was my novice level of expertise using VoiceOver, and I was right. Dr. Robert Carter of the Tech Doctor podcast wrote in to tell me that if I hold down Control-Option-Shift and then hit the letter M, it brings up the menu of available applications to record. Very cool. Piezo is accessible, and I learned a new trick. Also on the Mac Roundtable this week, we were chatting about recording options for Skype calls. I think this might have been off air. I'm not sure it was in the actual recording. Anyway, we were bemoaning how none of the options were ideal, since Wiretap Studio no longer allows you to record your voice and one application. You have to record all of your system sounds. Someone brought up Piezo as an option, but someone else pointed out that it didn't work because it records your own voice twice with an echo, once through the mic and once through Skype. We recorded on Tuesday, and on Wednesday, Rogue Amoeba came out with an update that specifically allows you to record Skype calls with your mic on one channel and the Skype caller on the other channel in stereo. I tested it out with a Skype test call, and it worked perfectly. It records to an AAC file, which is pretty good. I'd prefer it be uncompressed, but most normal people wouldn't want that anyway. So good job, Rogue Amoeba. This is now a really super useful application for podcasters, along with normal people. Speaking of the Mac Roundtable, check out show number 108. Chuck Joyner, Steve Stanger, Jeff Gamet, and John F. Braun and I talk about the tablet market, what we're looking forward to at Macworld iWorld, when we're all speaking at Macworld iWorld, and we go through our top holiday tech gifts. If you listen carefully, you can even hear me tell Chuck that I love him. So back on the Piezo subject, I did decide to put my money where my mouth is. I used Piezo to record chit-chat across the pond this week, and it worked beautifully. Like I said, it records to M4A, also known as AAC, which is a compressed format. And that means that the audio will be compressed twice by the time you hear it. Hope it survives okay. Let me know if you don't think it came out well. I think it's going to be fine, though, because many of our contributors send things in M4As from their iPhones, and they always sound fantastic. The main thing is that the workflow was so darn easy. I named the file before I started, and I hit record. While recording, I had a time counter, which is really important because I often take notes like 1839 buzzy meowed, and I try to cut those things out later. The M4A file was very small, around 90 megabytes, so that's nice too. To give you an example why that's so important, Steve did a call recorder backup for me, which was uncompressed, and it was an MOV format, which I don't understand why they do that. It was over 2 gigabytes. Anyway, let's see how all of this works out. Well, I continue to struggle in my journey to learn VoiceOver. I tell you, it's a lot harder than I thought it would be. I'm getting a lot of help when I ask, but it's still tough. I was trying to explain to Steve why it's so hard to ask for help. Here's an example. I'm trying to enter in a calendar invitation. In iCal, you hit Command-N to start a new invite, and then you can type in dinner tonight at 6 with Katie. It will record an event at 6 p.m. tonight, but I won't try to figure out who Katie is. I think it should. No worries, now it shows me an area where I can interact. So I hit Control-Option-Shift-Down-Arrow. So far, so good. That lets me interact. The first field it reads out loud to me, it says, unknown. Well, gee, that's really helpful, isn't it? Turns out for some reason it starts reading the location field, and since I haven't told it where I want to have the event, it is, of course, unknown. But it doesn't tell me it's on the location field. I actually have to flip to the left in order for it to hear it say location. Okay, fine. I'm stumbling along anyway, filling things in just fine, and then all of a sudden somebody sends me a tweet mention. That pops up Growl on my screen. But I don't know that Growl is on my screen. All I know is that all my arrowing typing is having no effect. It's just bonking away like when you play a video game and you're a spaz and you keep running into walls. It makes that kind of noise. I think I made to get to create a clean blindfolded account with virtually nothing running so I don't get my little self confused. Anyway, I've settled on the set of tasks I'm going to execute on stage. And believe it or not, this will take 45 minutes to execute. On iOS, I'm going to open the social folder, open Twitter, create a new tweet, and type in, I'm so happy to doing blindfold. And I'm going to hit tweet. Now I'm going to open text messages, click on new message, and enter Katie's Google Voice number. Send her a message that says, want to go to dinner tonight at 6 p.m. Hopefully she will respond from the audience in the affirmative. At that point, I'm going to turn off the iPhone. I figure that's a good 15 minutes right there. On OS X is where it gets harder. I'm going to open up Safari, navigate to Yelp, search for Italian restaurant, navigate down to a restaurant, navigate to the address and phone, and copy the address. Okay, now here's another place where this gets really tricky, and I did get help with this. When you get to the address field on using VoiceOver, it doesn't actually select the address field, so you have to select it. Well, the instructions that I read say to do it just like if you're a sightling, hold down the shift and do arrow keys across it. That doesn't work for some reason. I don't know why. Maybe it's something wrong with the way Yelp was created or something, but that doesn't work at all. So what I found out you can do is there's a thing that says, I think it's the VoiceOver keys, control option, and you hit CC, or maybe it's control option shift C, something like that. Anyway, what it does is it copies the last thing that VoiceOver said out loud. And since the last thing it said out loud was the address to the restaurant, that's how I'm going to capture it. Okay, so then I'm going to open up iCal, start a new calendar invitation, and I'm going to enter dinner at 6 p.m. tonight. iCal will open that event. I'm going to change the time duration to end at 8 p.m., and because it's going to do it from 6 to 7, but I'll change it to 8 p.m. Then in the location field, I'm going to type in the name of the restaurant and then paste in the address and phone. For some reason, it will yell at me and tell me it's malformed. I don't know why, but it does. It has little emergency symbols next to each piece of the address, and it says malformed, but I'll just keep moving. Then I'm going to add Katie as an attendee, and I'm going to change the alarm to 15 minutes before and send the invitation. I know that with my eyes open, this is maybe 3.5 minutes of work, but I do think I'll be lucky to execute all of that in 45 minutes. I'm also going to proceed all of this with a few keynote charts explaining why I'm doing this and the process I use to learn it, give some explanation of the resources out there, and of course to thank the blind folks who helped me on my journey. I'm exhausted just thinking about it. I am really, really glad they moved my time slot up to 11 a.m. on Thursday the 26th. I'd have been a wreck waiting till late Friday to do it like it originally was scheduled. Anyway, I got to keep practicing. I got to get better at this. I am still not good at it. Next up, let's hear a quick little message from good friend of the show, Rose.
G'day, girls and boys. It's Rose from Hobart. And I think I have a competition for the NoCilla Castaways. And it's relevant to the season. You know Christmas crackers and those dreadful jokes that come with them? I reckon we should have a competition to find the worst. And I think Stevie P should be the judge. Now, I'll start us off. Why do cows lie down together in the rain? To keep each udder dry. Did you like that one? Not so much? Okay, how about this one? Why do golfers wear two pair of pants? In case they get a hole in one. I've got a million of them, but I'll stop right there and let other people contribute.
All right, NoCilla Castaways, you heard Rose's challenge, and Stevie P says he's always wanted to be a judge. We actually do these crackers at my brother's house, so I think we'll be in the game. It looks like Kevin and Big in Virginia is definitely going to play, so let's see what we can find out. Good luck with the work on this contest, Steve. Well, I've told you guys a lot of times how much fun the live show is, and I am not making that up. We have a great time in there. It's actually one of my favorite times of the week. If you haven't given it a try, you're missing a real treat. Last week, the live audience was talking about roadkill while I was working. I often don't understand them, but they seem to really be enjoying themselves. Anyway, last week, Robert Harper, a.k.a. Lorethian, joined the show for the first time. He had a blast, and what was more interesting to me was why he chose to join the fun. He came just to tell me how much he's enjoying Clarify from BlueMangoLearning.com. Here's what he wrote. Allison, thanks for the recommendation on Clarify. You and that software have saved me thousands of dollars. I have to tell everyone, the reason I decided to come tonight was to personally thank Allison for the recommendation of Clarify. The software has saved me hours and thousands of dollars in the last month alone. I'm using it almost every day to give support to my staff on their computer questions. Thanks so much for the recommendation. I have salespeople that work for me, and as you all know, they have huge technology issues. We have an integration company, and what a month ago would take me 15 minutes to demonstrate one-on-one with each salesperson, I can now outline the process once and reuse it. I have used the How Do I Log On to My CCTV system 5 times in the last month alone. I am now doing how-to stuff for customers. Well, Robert, I gotta say, I'm really glad you came to the live show, and especially that you sent over this completely unsolicited testimonial for Clarify. It means more to people when they hear someone else tell other experiences. If you've got a need for a quick and easy way to explain things to people on the computer, you can save money and time and aggravation, like Robert, by using Clarify to write up quick little instructions with annotations and just make things really, really clear for people. It's only $29.99 in the Mac App Store, or you can get it for Windows for $30 or a cross-platform license for only $39.99.
George from Tulsa here, following up on a thread in last week's live chat. Yes, Steve, I'm a security fanatic. Which is why, yes, Allison, I delete cookies. Like most everyone, I access bank and broker accounts on the web. Brokers charge a lot more if you call instead of click. And with interest rates at zero and a stagnant stock market, you can't afford a professional whose fees are higher than your possible earnings. Here's some security tips for accessing your finances online. Don't use Windows. Don't put Windows on the Mac you use to manage your money. There's a theoretic chance a Windows virus can climb through and infest your Mac. Link in show notes. Don't presume Macs are free of viruses and malware. Just today, a friend I started on ClamX AV told me his Macs were infested by a Trojan ClamX removed. Use a password manager. I use one that keeps them locally and not on the net. But if you follow that suggestion, be sure to back your passwords up. If you can, change the logon your financial website first provides. Don't use your email address, or as in the case of one bank where I have accounts, the sequential number I was assigned. If possible, create a logon that's as hard to guess and crack as a good password. From Steve Gibson, we've learned to use the longest passwords a website will accept, and a password manager makes it easy to use logon IDs and passwords you'd never be able to remember. Create fake answers to security questions instead of answering with your mother's real maiden name. One of the weakest links in online security are the security questions used by many sites, and your mother's maiden name is just one genealogy search away. Use your password manager to store your fake answers. Most brokers and many banks provide free radio security tokens or offer to send codes to your cell. Get a security token or sign up for the cell phone system. Well worth the hassle if it keeps someone in Pakistan from draining your bank account, as happened to one of my coworkers. I use Firefox and only Firefox to access bank and broker accounts. I've added NoScript to block unwelcome JavaScripts, better privacy to clear persistent flash cookies, and Ghostery to block cookies and web bugs. I set Firefox to reset clean at every close, and I close and reset anytime I change among banks, brokers, or client accounts. NoScript isn't available on Google's Chrome, and the version of Ghostery provided on Google's Chrome Extension Store doesn't block Google's own trackers on Chrome. Go figure. I use the recently updated Camino browser to open websites that don't load right in my restricted versions of Firefox or Chrome. I reset Camino on every close. What I don't use is Apple's Safari. Apple has changed Safari as it moves to its sandboxing model. Especially in Lion, it is all but impossible for a user to control how Safari handles privacy. For one thing, Lion wants to restore Safari to its last saved state. For another, resetting Safari really resets it, including resetting extension settings, like my ghostly preference against web bugs. When Safari restarts after a reset, it loads most visited sites and starts filling itself with cookies, even when cookies are blocked. When the web was new, I did a search on a friend's recently diagnosed dread disease. That led to Internet Exploder playing many related ads. When emails about flaky cures started filling my inbox, I realized I'd been followed home. Some episodes ago, Dave and John complained about cookie and ad-blocking users freeloading off their site and asked for listener comments. Some context. Websites don't sell ads. They let others place ads on their sites and collect money. Google is the most common, but not only, provider. As Google counts ad views, it also captures information about the viewer and adds that data to a growing database. I presume, but don't know for sure, that over time Google and other ad trackers cross-index and cross-sell data, spreading a person's web history everywhere. John asked, "What difference does it make which brand of beer you drink?" Maybe it doesn't matter what brand you drink, but it might matter that you drink at all. All web trackers require to link your work computer to your home computer and private browsing history is a single Twitter, Facebook, Amazon, or email logon. And who doesn't do that over the lunch hour? Maybe in the privacy of your home, you've looked up a medical condition you don't want your boss to know about. I'm all for content providers like the Mac Observer making money. I donate to sites and podcasts which I access frequently. But while I'm willing to pay for valuable content, I'm not willing to pay with my privacy. So, at this giving time of year, if you're a regular listener or reader of a blog or podcast, look for a donation button on its site and send a few bucks. Bloggers, podcasters, and developers may be in it more for love than money, but send money. Love online can get you into trouble. Then feel no guilt about blocking cookies, web bugs, and ads. It is your privacy, and there's a lot more at stake than whether your favorite brew is Bud.
All right, George, thanks for the advice there. It sounds like pretty good advice to me. I really appreciate you giving us some tips to keeping ourselves safe, and I certainly can't argue with those last statements that you said. John Schaffer wrote in this week, and here's what he had to say. I found a website the other day, brdrck.me/settings, that will allow you to put links on your home screen of your iPhone to get to the Bluetooth and wireless settings with one click from your home screen. I've heard for a long time people who have Android phones saying what a great feature this is and asking why we don't have it. Well, and when I found this, I thought of you and your podcast and thought it might be a good way to let people know about it. I found it about a week ago and I've been really enjoying it. I have a link to start wireless sync on my home screen. I've attached a Screen Steps tutorial on how to install them on your iOS device. It's really simple and free. Well, thanks, John. This is really cool. I tested it out and I really like it. The one I'm most fond of is that Wi-Fi button. I'm often in situations where I need to shut off Wi-Fi on my devices, so having a one button click to get to that switch is simply awesome. I think I will do the one you have too for wireless syncing. I love wireless syncing. Being able to get to that with one button, that's going to be fantastic. By the way, you mentioned that it's a free service, which is technically true, but they do also have a donate link. So throw the developer a few bucks if you find this useful. The other thing is, don't be surprised if this doesn't work when you're offline, because it's actually going through the website each time to actually cause this button to work. I noticed a couple of times I could actually see it open up the website and then flip over and run the function. So it's kind of an interesting service. I would be interested in knowing how that works. So Steve really loves Christmas albums. He very specifically loves those sung by old-time crooners. You know, Bing Crosby, Nat King Cole, Perry Como, that kind of stuff, along with the other kinds of Christmas albums. Anyway, this year he asked for the Christmas album by the newest crooner, a young man named Michael Bublé. I stressed out for a while on where I'd find a CD. I mean, do they sell those anymore? And he specifically wanted the CD. Then I had one of those don't moments when I realized I could just buy it for him in iTunes. I know it's kind of slow that I didn't figure that out right away. But when I suggested this path to him, he said that he really wanted the physical media, specifically because that's how he listens to Christmas music in the car. I did promise during this discussion I would not mock him for just using, say, I don't know, his iPhone or his iPod Nano to play it. But it's killing me not to mock him for that. Anyway, I then reminded him that his Mac can burn CDs. Again, no mocking, but he said he wanted it nice with a label and the songs listing and all that jazz. That's when he had the moment of brilliance and he said, "Hey, Allison, doesn't Smile sell a product called Disc Label that'll do all that for me?" Well, a quick trip to smilesoftware.com and he had Disc Label installed. He already had some CD labels and jewel case inserts from Memorex, so when he looked in Disc Label and he was able to find the exact template he needed to match his labels. He found the album artwork online, no guilt about that since we did buy the album, and he dragged that onto the CD label. It was rectangular, which was a little weird for a circle, but he was able to drag it around until it covered a little more than half of the circle, but didn't cut Bublé in half, of course. Then he copied and pasted the names of the tracks from iTunes into a text box. This is where it got really cool and useful. Disc Label automatically keeps track of where the edges of the CD's outside and inside circles are, so when you move it around, it word wraps to make sure they don't get cut off where they were printed. Very, very cool. He was also able to make his jewel case. That was a lot easier since the front and back were rectangles, but again, that worked perfectly. Now, a key feature to why Disc Label makes your job so much easier than any other way of doing it is that it has a calibration feature to make sure the label prints exactly as it should on your stickers and jewel cases. Steve explained that you print a calibration page, and then you measure in millimeters where the calibration symbol is from the corner, and then you enter those measurements back into Disc Label. I remember the hours and hours we spent in Photoshop Elements trying to line up the labels, wasting a ton of money screwing it up because we kept printing these labels and they wouldn't be just right. I put a picture of Steve's masterpiece in the show notes so you can see how well it came out. I mean, it looks professionally done. Now, I should mention that Steve is very critical of software that doesn't work exactly like he thinks it should. More than willing to criticize, I should say. The only improvement idea he could come up with was that it might be easier to find the templates if they had the numbers on them from the manufacturer. He was able to find his label, but it would have been a smidge faster since Memorex sells a lot of different options for CD labels. Disc Label is only $35.99 in the Mac App Store, and of course, there's a link in the show notes to it from Smile. Well, before we jump into chit-chat across the pond, I would like to close out the regular part of the show with what is now a Christmas classic on the NoSilicast.
The Night Before Christmas, with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. With credit and apologies to Clement Clark Moore or Henry Livingston. 'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a trackpad. Okay, work with me here. The earbuds were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that all things iMaker soon would be there. The Nosilla castaways were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of iPads danced in their heads. And Potfeet in her kerchief, and I in my cravat, had just settled down for a long winter Skype chat. When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from the keyboard to see what was the matter. Away to the windows! I flew like a flash drive, tore open the shutters, and nearly did a nosedive. The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave the luster of brushed aluminum to objects below. when what to my eyes seemed very bizarre, but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny cars. With a little old driver with whom elves hobnob, I knew in a moment it must be Honda Bob. More rapid than 4G his vehicles they came, and he tweeted and shouted and called them by name. Now Accord, now Civic, now Fit and CRV, on Element, on Ridgeline, on Pilot and Odyssey. To the top of the porch, to the top of the wall. Now drive away, drive away, drive away all. As dry leaves that before the reality distortion field endowed, when they meet with an obstacle, mount to the cloud. So up to the housetop the vehicles they flew, with the sleigh of Apple products, and Honda Bob too. And then in a twinkling, I heard with a squeal the skidding and sliding of each little wheel. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney Bob came with a bound. He was dressed in coveralls from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with oil and soot. A bundle of SSDs he had flung in his Scotty vest, and he looked like a geek who was extremely obsessed. A wink of his eye and a look not too pious soon gave me to know he had a Macintosh bias. He spoke not a word, but texted his concern and filled all the stockings, then hit return. And laying his finger aside his levitation app, a command to his iPad, up the chimney ASAP. He sprang to his sleigh, and his autos did they bristle, and away they all flew as if shot from a missile. But I heard him exclaim, as the poem prescribed, "Happy Christmas to all, and please stay subscribed."
HDA Bob's Mobile Service is not affiliated with Honda Acura or Honda Worldwide.
Aw, that was so nice, Steve. There was a few tears in the eye of people missing Honda Bob in the live chat room. We'll all send out our holiday wishes to him and hope you're having a great time, Bob. He isn't retired anything. He's just not on the show anymore, but I'm sure he's still full of stuff and nonsense. Maybe we'll hear from him again soon. It's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond. And this week, we have a pair of people for Chit Chat Across the Pond. I've invited Bart and Steve Sheridan to try to explain to me, what is the Higgs boson and why do we care? So how are you doing today, Bart?
I have a cold, but I'll live.
You're all pumped up about the Higgs boson, though, right?
Oh, yeah. So energetic.
And Steve, how are you today to the crowd here?
Hey, I'm doing just fine. Happy to be here with you and Bart.
I think you've been more excited about the Higgs boson than just about anybody here. You've done a lot of work in the show notes.
Well, this particle really does blow my dress up.
Wait a second. You have a dress?
All right.
Just an expression.
That's for another show. All right. But before we kick into our fun and our propeller head talk, Bart, what do we got on Security Light for today?
I figure there's only one thing that fits the light category. There is some other security news, but I don't want to derail us with it because there's nothing you can do about it, so it doesn't fit the definition. Huh. So basically, it's a week, therefore Firefox has gone up a version.
Oh,
so
good.
You should now be on Firefox 9, or if you're sensible, on Firefox 3.6.25. Those are the only two safe versions of Firefox. 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 are not patched anymore, so you need to be on 9 or 3.6.25.
So tiresome. And that's it, though? That's all we got for Security Light?
That's all we got for Security Light. One other thing just to mention with the Firefox stupidity is that apparently from version 12 on, it will develop Chrome-like auto-updating. And here's the scary bit. Version 12 is due out in April. 2012. Not 2013. 2012.
Okay, because there are 3 months between now and then, right? So 9, 10, 11, 12.
There we go. It shouldn't be a problem. Shocking. But anyway, that's the state of play.
Oh, dear. All right. So I've been hearing a lot around my house about this Higgs boson thing and the Large Hadron Collider, and I nod knowingly and pretend I follow what Steve's talking about, but I thought maybe if I could get the two guys together, you could tell us what the Higgs boson particle is, why we care, and evidently we're spending a fair amount of money and time and energy, pun intended, and I'm not quite sure where we start, but there's the question. What's the answer?
Well,
why don't you kick it off?
What I suggested to Steve was that in order to put things into context, we should start with the standard model of the atom. And what I sort of had in my head was, you know, in school, we all learn that everything is made up of atoms. And that's pretty much where it stops. So we all know that atoms have protons and neutrons and electrons, and they spin around each other.
I'm with you so far.
The thing is, that's not the most basic stuff it gets. You can take those protons and neutrons and smash them into smaller pieces. And that is basically what particle physics is all about. And for a while, we had the problem that, first of all, we just thought, okay, the atom has a nucleus with positive charge and some neutrons and some electrons, and that was all fairly simple. And then we started to look at, using cloud chambers, what happens when particles smash together very hard using cosmic rays. And we started to find these other particles, and then we found some more particles, and then we found some more particles, and we ended up with more particles than we could take a stick at, to the point that it was utterly confusing, and I think someone called it a zoo of particles at one stage. And then the Standard Model came along to actually put some sense on it all, because all of these hundreds and hundreds of different types of particle, it just didn't make sense. And with the Standard Model, what the Standard Model did was it broke down that massive list of particles into a few subsets of types of particle. And it all comes around this notion of a quark to a large extent. And basically, if you take two quarks or three quarks and stick them together, you can make a particle. And there are six quarks. Therefore, if you start sticking them together in different combinations of six quarks, whereas for each quark, there's six versions of each quark, so you have six sixes is 36. And as you start jiggling these together again, you're able to build all these lots and lots of particles. So, you know, that's where we've come from the bit that you learned in school.
Okay.
So I guess just, I did a diagram because I figured that way it would help us understand sort of the universe according to the Standard Model. So we break the world into leptons, which are things like electrons, positrons, and neutrinos, and they don't get any smaller, they just are. And then we break it up into hadrons, which are the things made of quarks. So any two quarks gives a meson, and any three quarks gives a baryon. And the three quarks ones are the ones we know best, because protons and neutrons are three quark combinations, so they're baryons.
Okay.
And then the last bit of the equation is this idea of particles to mediate the forces. So this is very much a wave particle duality thing.
What
we have, according to the Standard Model, we have four forces in the universe, and everything is defined by those four forces. So you have electromagnetism, which is probably the one that we're all very familiar with. And the photon is a force-mediating particle for electromagnetism. Then we have gravity is the other obvious one. And the graviton is the theorized particle for gravity. It has not been discovered, so that's a gap in the theory so far.
And I think technically it's not in the Standard Model.
It depends on who you ask.
Ah.
Because as you wiki around, you either find people saying that the graviton is theorized, or you find people saying, we don't really know what the graviton is, and actually we can't make gravity and quantum mechanics work together because we haven't found a theory of quantum gravity.
Right.
So it's either an enigma of one sort or an enigma of another sort. We either give it a name but don't know what it is, or we're just kind of honest and saying,
okay, right. Okay.
And then the one that always confuses people is that there are two other forces that we don't think about in daily life because we're big. These forces only exist on the most infinitesimally small scale, and they're the forces that make it possible to take two protons, which are both positively charged, and stick them together. Because, you know, we all know from electromagnetism that like charges repel. So if you take something negative and you put it together, they should fly away from each other, and the same with two positive things.
That would seem to take a strong force, Bart.
Precisely. So it's called the nuclear strong force, and the particles that make them stick together are wonderfully named. My favorite name in particle physics, gluons, glue protons.
That is a great name.
For once, they made sense.
And in order to make the whole thing work, you also need another force, the weak nuclear force, which is mediated by the bosons. So basically you have electromagnetism, gravity, nuclear, strong and weak, and they're held together by photons, gravitons, bosons, and gluons.
I'd like to add something about the gluon strong nuclear force. I like that one because the further apart you pull these two protons or these two nuclei, the stronger the force gets, unlike all these other forces.
Hmm.
It's a little different in that manner.
Up to a point, and then it just...
To a point, right.
So none of these forces exist on scales even close to what we'd experience. I mean, these things don't even exist on the cellular scale. You really are down into atoms for these forces to exist. And then the last piece of the puzzle is the Higgs boson, which is the subject of today's discussion. And the reason the Higgs is important is because the Higgs field explains why things have mass, which is something we're all pretty sure they have since we experience it all the time. And at this time of year, we all have a little bit more mass than we should when we get on those weighing scales. So that's the big 20,000-foot view.
Okay, so this Higgs field causes things to have mass.
Yes.
Okay. Forgive me, but that sounds a little bit like in the old days when they referred to the ether. You know, it's like, okay, and then we don't understand anything else, so we think there's just this thing just kind of floating all over everything. We don't know where it is, what it is, but we think it's there.
To some extent, yes. Although in the case of the Higgs, it's a little different to the ether because we know or we theorize some of its properties. So it's the four forces can be unified and they have to separate apart as you get less and less energy in the system. So at the point of the Big Bang, the theory goes there was one force. And then as energies got lower, the forces split up and started to become separate forces. And for that to be possible, you need, you know, the Higgs field is a good way to do it. So that's kind of where it comes from. And it explains mass. So, I mean,
okay.
If we find it, then, you know, we know we were right. And if we don't find it, then we have an even more interesting result, which is that we don't know we were right.
Exactly. Let me say something about mass versus weight, because that gets a little bit confusing. But when we talk about mass, we're talking about what makes matter resist its motion or resist wanting to move. So if you try to accelerate something that has mass, it'll push against you as you try to accelerate it. That's because of its mass,
which is called inertia. Is another word people might have heard for it.
Right, exactly. But you don't need gravity to demonstrate something has mass. That would be weight. That's the force existed on something that has mass.
Okay, I remember that part.
So the reason that's important is because this Higgs field imparts mass, not weight, but mass to all of these or some of these particles that Bart mentioned.
So
doesn't give them weight.
This is going to sound really stupid here, but I thought things had mass because they had dense things in them. For example, a balloon doesn't have a lot of mass because it's got really light stuff in it. And where I've got bacon and eggs in me, I've got more mass. Well, what's that got to do with the Higgs boson?
Okay, because you got to take it down the chain of things. So your balloon is made of plastic, which is made of molecules, which is made of atoms, which is made of subatomic particles. And those subatomic particles, some of them do bang into the Higgs field and get affected by it, and some of them don't. And some of them bang into it more strongly than others. So some of those little subatomic particles making up the atoms, making up the molecules, have a little bit of mass. Some of them have no mass, and some of them have a lot of mass. So air doesn't have many particles in it at all, so it doesn't weigh nearly as much because there's just much less of them. Whereas the balloon has a little bit more, but there's not that much of it anyway. So it all comes back down to the subatomic particles and how they bang into the Higgs field. And stuff like the photon doesn't bang into the Higgs field at all. It doesn't feel the Higgs field, so a photon has zero mass.
Okay.
And by the way, that's the only reason it can move at the speed of light.
Yes. Because there ain't nothing holding it back.
Yep.
Okay, but that's a subject for another day. Okay, yes. So we built some giant accelerator in Lucerne, Switzerland, I think. Is that right?
Not Lucerne.
CERN.
It's actually by Geneva, and it's operated by an organization called CERN.
Which is an acronym Americans have trouble with because it's not in English. It's the Centre Européen de Recherche Nucléaire, European Centre for Nuclear Research.
So that's why I thought it was in Lucerne, which is in the wrong country. Okay, anyway.
Go on, Steve. I think you're about to
say it. It's actually quite close to Geneva, and it's on the border of France and Switzerland.
Okay. There's a joke amidst physicists that if you want to make some money, what you need to do is put an import duty on particles because they go around at the speed of light into France, into Switzerland, into France, into Switzerland, into France, into Switzerland. So you just tax them a tiny little bit,
I like it. Okay, so that's called the Large Hadron Collider. We just learned that hadrons are, luckily I have a picture to remind me, mesons and baryons.
They're things made of quarks.
Things made of quarks, right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Steve, what are we doing there? What are we trying to figure out?
Well, so the LHC, as we like to abbreviate it, was basically built to smash together protons at very, very high speed and produce some energies and resulting subatomic particles that we have not been able to observe before. And one of those is the Higgs boson, but there are others that can be observed that have not been before or can be observed in finer detail than have been before.
So in some ways it's wonderfully primal. If you want to see what something's made of, you whack it together very hard.
Did boys invent this?
Yes.
Probably.
I'm sorry, but the girl's first reaction to figure out what something is it to hit it? But boys, it does tend to be more often.
Yeah. So the reason you got to hit it very hard is to give it lots and lots of energy. And when you have lots of energy, the quarks and the other subatomic particles can be free momentarily. And they can hit your detector, and you can then very briefly see them before they decay back into, you know, whatever they were before. So the more energy you have, the more stuff you can liberate and the more stuff you can observe. And one of the reasons that CERN was literally closed for years to build the LHC, because the tunnel's been there for years, but what they do every now and then is they strip all the stuff out of the tunnel and put in, you know, upgraded kit. And the LHC is the latest upgrade to the kit, and they have been years building it. And the reason is because the theory suggests that we should find the Higgs boson sort of between energies of, I think it's 115 and 130 mega electron volts. And in order to smash things together hard enough, we needed new gear. And the whole thing is full of superconducting magnets that have to be cryogenically cooled just to allow these things to create the massive magnetic fields needed to accelerate these things round and round and round and round in circles at like almost the speed of light. So you have two beams running against each other, just missing each other, and then you use magnets at the very last second to make the beams cross exactly in your experiment, and then you literally, you have layers and layers of sensors around that just catch the debris.
And catch the debris in the word, you said you see them on your sensor. What do you mean by see?
You fill the sensor with something that the particles will interact with. So you have different sensors to look for different things. But anything that has a magnetic field will interact with magnetic fields and it will curve off, and anything, you know, electric fields. And you put up sensors. It's almost...
But I mean, are they sensing energy?
Yes. And you make the particles give off their energy into the sensor. So it's a bit like looking for flies by driving around at high speed with a windshield.
Okay.
You know, and depending on the type, you know, how much mass it has, it'll make a bigger or smaller hole in your windshield. And
it's a little
imperfect analogy. But you mess with the charge by seeing how much it deflects if it goes through a magnetic field and those kind of things. But basically, the particles will decay and you watch them do it.
And both the energy and the direction that it emerges from that collision are important.
Yes.
Because that direction can give you the charge of the particle because it's in a magnetic field.
Okay.
So you basically get pictures. It will actually draw you a picture of lines coming out of the crash, and they'll all be curving by different amounts depending on how strongly charged they are, how much mass they are, what spin they have, and all these other properties that they have. And so by looking at the shape of the line, you can tell about the particle.
So there's a lot of particles we already know about. Is there a problem of finding a new particle amongst the noise of all the particles that we already know about and we can see?
Yes.
Yes.
Putting on my computer scientist hat, the search for these particles is an unbelievable problem. The amount of terabytes of data that come out of a single collision is unbelievable. And this concept of the data grid, sort of Internet 2, as some people call it, is entirely driven by CERN. And it's probably not an accident that the World Wide Web came out of CERN as well. I mean, that's where Tim Berners-Lee was working.
Hmm.
So CERN is a cutting-edge computer science place as well as a cutting-edge particle physics place, because you have so much data. And the lighter the particle is, the less mass it has, the more of them you'll make. And so if you're trying to find something like the Higgs that is going to be very rare because it has, you know, it's 130 MeV, then you're going to have billions and billions and billions of non-Higgs produced. And you need to discard all that data.
Let me add, it's giga electron volts.
Oops, did I say mega? Yeah, I'm only selling it short by 1,000.
Okay, so I don't actually normally speak in giga electron volts. Is that the numbers that you're saying, that, what was it, 128-ish giga electron volts? Is that a big number or a small number?
Depends on whether you're an atom or a person.
It's big for a fundamental particle.
Okay.
Just put in perspective, a proton... and by the way, we're talking about electron volts, which are measures of energy, but you divide that by C squared, and that gives you the equivalent mass. But physicists often talk in terms of the energy, which equates back to the mass.
Ooh, that's so this, the E equals MC squared thing?
That is exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. Nice. So to get M, you divide E by C squared.
Okay. As C being the speed of light. Okay.
Correct. So take everything, when we say giga electron volts or mega, take that and divide by C squared, and you got the mass.
Okay.
In any case, so we're talking about the Higgs around 124 to 126 giga electron volts. That's a billion electron volts. But a proton is just under 1 billion electron volts. So this Higgs is 125 times more massive than a proton. So for a subatomic particle, that's pretty heavy. Pretty massive, I should say.
Yeah. I mean, these energies, the reason they use electron volts instead of sort of the normal day-to-day energies that we talk about is because the numbers would just be horrific.
Right, right.
So, I mean, an electron volt is 1.6 by 10 to the minus 19 joules. I mean, joules are the units we use in the real world. So that's, you move the decimal point 19 places over, so 19 extra zeros on 1.6. I mean, it's absolutely tiny numbers.
Sure. Okay, so now we said earlier that the Higgs field is going to explain mass. What's the connection from the Higgs field to the Higgs boson?
Steve, do you want to?
Yeah, okay. This gets back to what Bart said about the particle wave duality.
Uh-oh.
And Bart explained that there were four fundamental forces, right?
Right.
One of those, those were, you know, the electromagnetism, gravity, the weak and strong nuclear forces. Well, these force mediators are the particles that are the equivalent of the waves or fields of each of those forces. So those forces have a field property, electromagnetic field, and then a quantum measurement of that field is the photon in the case of electromagnetism.
Eyes
in the case of the Higgs,
glazed over. Lost you. No idea what you just said.
Okay. Well, this comes back to the big argument between, was it Newton on one side, and I'm trying to remember who it was on the wave side. If you take light.
Schrodinger?
Well, no, Newton was particle as well, where Schrodinger was wave, was he?
Yes.
Okay. So if you look at light and you ask it a wavy question, you will get a wavy answer. So if you say that light comes in waves, therefore waves should interfere with each other, and you do the experiment with the Young's double slit. Young, that's who it was. It was Young and Einstein. You use a Young's double slit experiment, you will see an interference pattern.
Like a good wave should give you.
Yeah. So you can say that electricity is a wave. Or sorry, that light is a wave.
Okay.
But if you ask it a particle-y question, you can actually get light to come in individual particles of light called photons, which Einstein discovered using the photoelectric effect.
Okay.
So light is both a particle and a wave, which is why we have the name wave-particle duality. So you can either say it's neither or it's both, but in reality all you care about is that mathematically it can behave like either.
Okay, so I'm at peace with that as much as it disturbs me.
Okay, so that's disturbing enough, right?
It should disturb you because that's hard to fathom for most people.
Oh, it's head-wrecking stuff. I think it was... I can't remember. It was one of the famous scientists said that if you understand quantum mechanics, you don't understand quantum mechanics.
Yes.
I think that was Bourne said that.
Okay, wait. Quick.
So that's head-wrecking, right? But we're going to wreck your head one step further.
Okay.
So that was the wave-particle duality of light was the first one discovered. And then people asked the question, what if we do it the other way around? What if we look at something that we know as a particle, like the electron, and what if we try to make it behave like a wave? And lo and behold, you can.
Ew.
Yeah.
And if you apply the equations, snooker balls, you name it, everything behaves like a wave or a particle if you ask it the right question. So that is kind of freaky, but that tells you that for every field, there is a particle, or for every particle, there is a field, because in actual fact, the two are the same thing.
So a field is a wave.
They just have different aspects.
A field is a wave.
A field is just a way of describing a wave.
Yeah. Ah, that's the connection I was missing.
Yeah, so yeah, it's sort of mathematically somewhat different, but effectively, yes. We have electromagnetic fields, electromagnetic waves, same thing.
Okay. Okay, that was a fundamental piece I was missing right there. Before we go too much further, though, when you were just saying about if you understand quantum mechanics, you don't understand quantum mechanics, Steve and I took quantum mechanics from a professor named Professor Van Hoven at UC Irvine in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And we were so lost in that class that we developed a theory that the Russians had staffed all of the universities in the United States with Russian spies who were spouting complete and utter gibberish, and that like 20 years from now, the entire industry of the United States would fall apart because all the physicists and engineers would be completely confused. So maybe we did understand.
This is still the Cold War era.
There's logic to that theory.
So maybe we did understand. All right. That was just a little quick interlude. Okay, so we're looking. If we can find the Higgs boson, that proves the field, because waves are particles and particles are waves.
Yes. Or they're neither and they just behave like both. Whatever way you want to think. Whatever way you want to make that not hurt your head.
Okay.
But remember, the Higgs boson and all these particles we talk about are the smallest unit you can divide that field or wave into. It's the quantum measurement of that wave in terms
sure.
of its energy.
You people always say those things, and then later it gets smaller. I don't believe that.
Well, no. I mean, quantization is measured. We know quantization. So hence we have things like Planck's constant describing the quantization of light. So, I mean, it's directly... It's what
That's
Einstein
well
did to win his Nobel Prize, is to show, despite what everyone thought, that light is quantized. And it's quantized according to Planck's constant. That is...
I'm pretty sure that one's for real, huh?
That is for real. And okay. I guess what we haven't been able to do is quantize gravity, which is why the graviton has a giant big question mark in my diagram. Because we know gravity is waves, but we ain't got no idea about no graviton particle. That one is still up for debate big time.
So fun for later. Okay, so let's say we find this. Well, so we're looking for the Higgs boson. We're driving our car around with a windshield, and we're smashing. We're looking for bugs to smash into, but we don't actually know where those bugs are, right? We're just kind of flinging around looking for them, and that's where we were up until just recently. Is that right?
Not quite. We're not quite flailing around in the complete dark. Not quite. You can look at it as being a search space, in terms of the amount of energy that you're exposing in your experiment. And so we've searched through the low energy spectrum pretty efficiently. It's like we've run around with a red torch and there ain't nothing red out there. Okay. And so then we change the red torch to a blue torch. And we've had a look around with a blue torch and there ain't nothing out there either. And now we're heading up sort of to ultraviolet torch, to continue my analogy poorly. And the LHC has the energy, has more than enough energy to find where we think the Higgs should be if our theories are right. Okay. So we're going to shine that ultraviolet torch, and either the Higgs boson will be found or it will not. And either way, it's unbelievably important to science.
So if we don't find it, that's also interesting. That doesn't mean it's does that. If we don't find it, does that mean it's unfindable?
If we don't find it after we do enough experiments, then we can say it's not there to a certain order of probability, and I think it's the confidence interval of 95% is what scientists generally aim for. So if we search really hard and we have a really good, really powerful spotlight and it is just not there, no, it's like wandering around a room looking for a football, and if you have put your hand into every single space that's the size of your hand, then you haven't touched the football. The football's probably not there.
Right.
So if we search really hard...
But that's also a possibility, right?
Absolutely. That's why we're doing the experiments.
Okay.
We never quite know. So either it's there, and then one of two things happens. It's either there where we expect it to be, and we can put a big check mark next to most of the standard model. It still leaves the graviton problem. But, you know, it's a big checkbox on the standard model. The standard model is kind of cool because it was developed long before most of the particles in it were found. And so we've been going along saying, well, the standard model says we should find X and it should have these properties. And we go and we look and lo and behold, there it is. And one of the missing X's is the Higgs. Okay. That's a very big deal if we were to just be able to put a tick mark next to that. That would be really cool.
But the isn't it the last missing, besides the graviton, isn't it the last missing particle?
Yep, it is. And it's sort of a very important one. So it's the last one that's missing. And it's one of the most important ones. Because without it, we do not understand how mass exists. And we know mass exists. That's kind of not up for debate. And it's a bit of a shame, really, that we don't have a proper physical theory to explain it. So if we find that, we can put a big tick box next to mass and say, okay, we finally, after thousands of years, have an actual working theory of what mass is. If we find that and it's not at the right energy, then we have another very interesting problem, because it means that our theories are probably close, but they're not quite right. They're missing something. Or we could not find that, in which case our theories have an even bigger hole in it, and then we have much more work to do. But scientifically speaking, not finding it is probably more exciting.
Because it gives more work to physicists, more things to go look at and investigate.
Yeah, mysteries are what make really cool science. So I think it was Kelvin, Lord Kelvin, who famously said that with the exception of tying up a few loose ends, science has it all figured out. Right? Which is a stupid thing to say.
What year was that, Bart?
Late 1800s.
A few loose ends.
Nothing's changed since then.
So, but it really also fits in alignment with somebody else said the best thing you can hear in physics is, or in science at all, is when you hear the phrase, well, that's interesting.
Or you hear it described as WTF sometimes, yeah. Well, or, oh, but never Eureka. It's generally, huh?
Yeah, and that's when things get like really fun, right?
So Kelvin said that there was nothing to be apart from these few loose ends, and two of those loose ends, ironically, led to relativity in quantum mechanics, which is why loose ends are great. So the first loose end was black body radiation. No one could explain the curve. And that led us to quantization, the Planck constant, and all of particle physics. And the other one that couldn't be explained was why Mercury's orbit was just a little bit off. Every time it orbited the sun, the point where it came closest to the sun was just off by a little bit from where it should be, according to Newtonian gravity. And you could observe it year after year after year, and every time it was out by the same little bit, and no one could explain it. And Einstein used general relativity is what explains the precession of Mercury's perihelion. And so the tiniest little loose end can unravel into an entire new branch of physics. So if the Higgs is not found, we are probably on the cusp of a giant new, you know, relativity / quantum mechanics style new change of thinking. If we do find that, okay, it's great, we know that we're doing well, but that's not as much fun.
So, Steve, the reason I wanted to have you guys on to talk about this was just last week or the week before, I remember you came in all Twitter-pated because some big thing had been excited. Something happened at the LHC about the Higgs boson. Exactly what happened?
Yeah, so on December 13th, so the work was done throughout the year, but the announcement was made by two teams at CERN working on the LHC, and one team works with a detector called ATLAS, and the other team works with a detector called CMS. And those are just two different methods for measuring these particles as they collide and all the output. They announced that they had further narrowed down where the Higgs mass must be to a fairly narrow range, and one that agreed with each other, even though their measurements were independent. And that mass... And that mass was around 124 to 126 billion electron volts.
But how could they be different studies if it's the same particle accelerator with the same data?
Well, so it's not the same data, though. And
yeah.
Imagine it's a racetrack. You can put different things on the racetrack as well. And you can have different ways of measuring. So you can have a guy there with a speed gun, or you could have a guy there listening to the Doppler sound, or you could have a guy who has a rope across it and measures the amount of force on the rope when a car goes by. You can measure speed in lots of different ways, okay, even though it's the same racetrack.
So these two teams were measuring different things at different times with different tools and came up with the same independent range.
With an independent method of doing that. Their measurement methods were completely different, even though they used the same beam of protons hitting one another.
So if they both said it's between 124 and 126 gig electron volts, even though we don't know quite where it is yet, doesn't that mean it definitely exists?
This gets down to uncertainty. Okay. Physicists never like to say that they found something or discovered something with 100% certainty, because they have the advantage of actually being able to predict the uncertainty with which they make measurements.
Well, it's not predict, it's quantify.
Yeah, right.
When you do your experiment, exactly. You can say this result is valid plus or minus a certain unit, or it's usually expressed as a confidence interval, which is just pure math. So you do the math, and how certain you are pops out as a number.
Yes, and that is, you're right, it's not predictable, it's measurable, that uncertainty.
Okay, but they're still saying they know it's between these two numbers, aren't they? Which means it is.
With a certain certainty. And that certainty is not 100%.
I don't suppose you happen to know what the confidence interval is, because generally speaking, when you get to 95% confidence interval, you write your big paper in Nature, you collect your Nobel Prize, and you go home.
I think I recall something on the order of 2.5 sigma of uncertainty for at least one of the teams, and that's not good enough for them to say conclusively that they found it. So what they need to do is make more measurements, and they plan to do this over 2012. And really hone in on that uncertainty, reduce it to a level where they can confidently say, yes, we have indeed found the Higgs boson, and this is its mass.
So it's basically a signal-to-noise problem. So there's so much going on there, and you can't measure everything perfectly, that you have noise in your data. And you keep gathering data until the point where the signal is very clear through the noise, and then you can be confident in your result. So I guess what you can say is it's looking really good. The data is starting. The fuzz is starting to come off the television. We're almost tuned into the channel, so we're getting close.
But you can tell the channel's there. Still,
you can tell the channel's probably there. Is it a picture showing snow, or is it just fuzz?
So, Steve, you wrote in the show notes that they've estimated the probability that the recent Higgs mass measurements are wrong is 1 in 1,000. That's a lot more than 95%.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if that's correct. I need to go back and check that because that's much different than.
Well,
no,
but a 95% confidence interval isn't 95% certain. The math in a confidence interval is different. I think it's like 5 nines or something.
Okay.
I don't remember the exact math because it's been too long since my physics degree, but a 95% confidence interval doesn't mean you're 95% certain.
Okay.
And I think, as Steve said, now they seem to be using the sigma notation, which is something we learned existed, but were never thought. So I don't even know how good or bad that is, the amount of sigma they have.
Okay.
I think they're looking for 5 to 6 sigma of uncertainty.
Yeah, and the higher sigma is good.
Correct.
It means that you're more certain of your answer.
That sigma kind of represents the tail of that probability curve, Allison, that you know, so
right.
That tail, when you cut off the tail, that's the area under that tail is the probability that you're wrong.
Right.
And that sigma represents how many distances, standard deviations you are away from the mean.
Right. Okay, so I actually have a bit of information to add to the discussion. Someone might ask why they aren't still collecting data right now, and my understanding is that the Large Hadron Collider requires what I think is scientifically referred to as a crap load of energy to run. and so they can't run it during the winter, or nobody would have heat and electricity in their homes in Switzerland and France. So they have to wait.
Well, Geneva.
Just in Geneva?
Not the entire country. Just the local cities.
So just a few million people would freeze to death if they ran it.
I mean, basically, you have a lot of nuclear power in France, and nuclear power is a nice steady stream. So it makes sense to divert some of that steady stream into the LHC when you don't need it to make everyone warm, because the atoms are still making it.
Okay, there we go. All right, so why do we care? Now I understand what we're looking for, and I understand that it would mean that we'd understand why we have mass, but I know it's because I ate too much bacon and eggs, so why do we care?
I mean, in that one sense, it's because it's one of the biggest mysteries in physics that we appear to be on the cusp of putting a checkbox next to.
Yeah, it completes the standard model, virtually completes it. And so just that in itself would be a huge bow on the top of this model that's been refined for over 40 years in physics. But that's just one thing, right? Think about electricity when it was first discovered, in the late 1800s. Hmm. And people could not have envisioned what the electron and what electricity would do in our future once we characterized it, harnessed it, and started using it. Back then, it was a novelty, this new particle, this new field. Who knows what the Higgs boson will become someday in the future as we know what it is, as we can maybe harness it, as we know how it interacts with matter more. There's just so much that could come out of it that we can't even envision today.
It's in some ways it would be as seminal as the eclipse observations made to confirm Einstein's theory of relativity. I mean, it's all good. Einstein wrote his stuff down on paper, and yeah, it happened to agree with the Mercury precession, but it wasn't a real test because you can't test on something that you know before you start your theory. Because you can just say, well, Einstein tuned the theory to answer the question he was trying to answer. But when Einstein predicted that if I'm right, the amount that starlight is bent by the sun would be twice as much as what Newton says it would be. And they went out, they did the experiment, and he was exactly right. And that's the moment when Einstein went from being a weirdo in the patent office to being one of the world's most famous scientists. That was the moment, because his theory was proved by an observation. So if the Higgs is actually seen, then it goes from being an interesting idea to being something that we know. And that, I mean, the importance for physics, you can't overstate it.
Yes, and the Standard Model is kind of the basis for some other more esoteric, some more exotic models beyond the Standard Model. If we confirm the Higgs is indeed what we think it is, I think that provides a jump-off point to now go explore these other models in more depth, like supersymmetry and some of the others. And those are very exotic and can yield even more strange particles than we know of today.
Okay. So is this just one of those things, and I think this is harder for non-scientists to really get a hold of, is sometimes you just have to understand. And when you do understand, then other things come out of it.
Well, yeah. You can't keep theorizing based on assumption on top of assumption on top of assumption. Because you end up with just an infinite amount of possible theories. But if you can lock down the Higgs, then you can dismiss all of the theories that don't agree with that. And then you have a whole new search space that you can start exploring.
Sure.
Right. It forms the base upon which you can further develop your theories.
Yeah, you continue to speculate, make more predictions, and go measure more things, but at least it rules out an infinity of other possibilities that we have to keep in mind now because we haven't nailed down the Higgs.
But I guess I'm thinking about in terms of how does it affect Allison's life tomorrow? That if we say, yes, it's 125.3 gig electron volts.
It doesn't affect your life tomorrow.
Probably won't.
But it could affect somebody's life someday, where we go in the universe, how we travel. It could be all kinds of things,
yes.
Right?
If you think about it, it was equivalent to the day the electron was discovered. At the time, it had no effect. Okay, so there's a subatomic particle that we can't see that carries a charge of -1 and that goes around yokes to be atoms. Didn't mean anything to anyone. That is the basis of almost every device we use today. So right, 100 right. years from now is probably massively important. A minute from now, irrelevant.
And that's why we have to search for these things. All right. Well, I think I actually I think I followed this. For anybody who wants to understand more, there are massive show notes with a lot more detail than we actually went through here. But I think you guys did a good job of actually bringing it down. Now, I mean, I have taken quantum mechanics, but it was 30 years ago and I didn't follow it then. So I still think it was a challenge to pull this off, explaining it to me.
Well, something I find is very fun is that I graduated a decade and a little bit ago. And there's not much of what I learned in my final year of experimental physics that has changed. This stuff has.
Yeah.
So that's what makes it fun.
Yeah. This is really cutting-edge stuff that my 10-year-old degree is wrong in this in this area. I think that's cool.
Very, very fun. Well, thank you both. Thank you, Steve, for joining us. And I know you did a lot of work on the show notes here, too, and helped me to understand. I appreciate you helping out, Steve.
My pleasure. It was fun. We should do this again sometime. Okay. Maybe when we get the next subatomic particle discovered.
Oh, we find that graviton. That's
you got it. I'll take you up on that, Bart.
I sent you sent you a link today that they actually did discover something just like yesterday, right?
Yes, you did.
The is it pronounced Chi B? C-H-I-B or it's Chib.
Chib. No, that's definitely Chi.
I think it's Chi B.
And what was that?
It's a new boson. Remember the little lesson from Bart on bosons?
Going back to my
this
picture.
One, and he talked about how you could have two quarks tied together to form a meson.
Right.
I think that's what this is. It's a beauty anti-quark and a beauty quark tied together.
Yep, that's a meson.
With a strong nuclear force. And so one other thing. So the standard model predicted this. This is the first time it's been verified to exist with the correct masses and so forth.
Actually, we should say that top and bottom quarks are also called truth and beauty. I think that's what the T is. So two beauties or two bottoms together. That is two of the heaviest of the quarks together. So you have two heavy things making a very heavy thing, which is why it's not one we would have found easily. Because you need a lot of energy to get it. So it's much easier to find two downs, two ups and a down, two downs and an up, which are your proton and your neutron, than it is to find two bottoms or two beauties. Beauty is a much nicer name than bottom, actually. We'll say with beauty.
Yes.
Well, my favorite thing in the article that I found that I sent you about that, Steve, was that someone in the comments referred to a beauty quark, and it was a picture of Quark from Star Trek in an evening gown.
It was not flattering.
Actually, just one last thing on quarks. It's one of the few things that can be attributed to an Irishman. Sugar. I hate when my mind goes blank. The guy who wrote Ulysses.
How much more Irish
can you get? Bloomsday. Our best writer ever in Irish history, and I've forgotten his name. Oh, Bren. I can see Bren Finan shouting on his iPod now.
James Joyce.
Thank you.
He's a physicist?
A quark is mentioned in Ulysses.
Really?
And it probably refers to, I believe it's a measure of whiskey.
Does that count?
Yeah, well, that's where the name comes from. And when they were looking for something to call these theoretical particles, the name stuck. Someone had obviously been reading Ulysses and went, that's a cool word. I want to use that word for something.
I like that.
All right. Well, we've managed to degrade the conversation completely, so I am going to draw us to a close. And thank you, Bart, for your contributions here. This was fun.
No, but cheers. But most of the thanks go to Steve. His show notes are fantastic. I just drew a picture.
And a wonderful picture it is. I think I'm going to put that one up on my wall.
I hope it's right.
Maybe on the refrigerator. That would be awesome. All right. Say goodnight, Bart.
Good night, Bart. Oh, wait. No, sorry. Until next time, happy computing. That's what I say.
Oh, my gosh. That one took a lot of brain cells, didn't it? Well, I warned you. I told you to look at the diagram and read along in the show notes, or you wouldn't be able to keep up with that one. It was pretty tough, but I really enjoyed myself. Except for that one time where I said I'd lost them completely, I pretty much kept up. I hope you learned something from this, too. Well, it's time to call it a day. Merry Christmas to all, and whatever holiday you may celebrate, Festivus, whatever you got. Let you be safe and happy and get really good tech toys this year. One more thanks to our sponsors for helping to pay the bills. We've got Blue Mango Learning and Smile. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. I contribute a fair amount over on Google+ nowadays, so just search for me by name if you want to circle me up. And if you want to join in the fun of the live show like everyone did this week, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.